Hi. Hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Somos Ancestria and Genobank, where, like this week, we really sharpened our focus on encryption in practice. Now, I had Kevin McCarthy from Infra, my podcast, on March the 15th, and that was a great episode. And he introduced me to TNO, a Netherlands independent research organization whose mission is to connect people and knowledge to create innovations that boost the competitive strength of industry and the well-being of society in a sustainable way. Now, that is a mission statement. And they also cover a lot of ground, one of which is privacy and privacy-enhancing technologies. They collaborate with the government and academia as well. So it really lets them fulfill that mission. That mission is real. When I first started down this road, I thought homomorphic encryption was the big story. But what I quickly learned was that that is not the case. The big story is about optimizing and integrating a wide array of emerging privacy and learning technologies to better enable outcome. But what does that actually mean? This is what Thomas and I delve into in this episode. So this episode, like the last one, is less about what the future could be and more about what the future is. Welcome to the Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. Hi, this is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy. Today, I am delighted to have Thomas Atema, a cryptographer at TNO, which is an applied research institute in the Netherlands. I was introduced to Thomas because TNO is an applied research institute focusing on privacy-enhancing technologies and their applications. And they've really done an awful lot in the space that's caught a lot of attention from a number of cryptographers in the space. So I thought it was an excellent opportunity to bring somebody on who had a real practical application perspective on the use of privacy-enhancing technologies and has done research and contemplated future use cases. So, Thomas, with that, welcome to the Encrypted Economy.
Thank you, Eric, and thanks for having me.
Excellent. So Thomas, I gave a little bit on who you were, but if you could give us maybe a little bit of background on you and what got you interested in cryptography.
Yeah, sure. My background is in mathematics. I studied mathematics in Utrecht, also in the Netherlands, and I graduated in algebraic number theory back in 2013. And after graduating from university, I started working at TNO. So as you already mentioned, TNO is an applied research institute, and one of the topics we work on a lot is privacy-enhancing technologies, but we do much more than that. The topics we work on at TNO range from, solving all sorts of societal challenges. For example, working on climate change, but also security of the digital society. So all sorts of different topics. And I started working at TNO on topics not related to cryptography at all. So I worked on the efficiency of telecommunication networks, on structural reliability, so basically the degradation of bridges in the Netherlands, but also in cybersecurity, intrusion detection systems. So a wide variety of topics. But the common denominator in all these topics was that we were applying mathematical techniques to solve network-related problems in these different domains. So I did all sorts of things, very different from cryptography. And in 2016, I got to know one of my colleagues, and he told me about his work on multi-party computation and cryptography in general. And he got me really enthusiastic. So that's when I decided I wanted to also work on this topic. And my background in algebraic number theory really fitted well or matched well with cryptography. So I could jump right into this. This is really cool. And nowadays I work full time on cryptography, working on topics as multi-party computation, but also zero knowledge proofs and post-quantum cryptography. And in 2018, I also started doing a part-time PhD at the cryptology group of CWI, which is a fundamental research institute in the Netherlands on mathematics and computer science. I'm also affiliated to the University of Leiden with respect to this part-time PhD program. So that's a quick introduction, Eric.
So it seems like you just can't get enough, huh?
I can't get enough of cryptography, that's for sure.
There you go. You got the bug. So exciting stuff. And so was there something specific that ultimately got you, or can you tell us maybe your personal experience with, you know, that moment that it just really clicked for you with cryptography?
Yeah, so this colleague of mine, Thijs, he told me about multi-party computation. Well, what really got to me was basically the counterintuitive functionalities that he was talking about. To me, it was at that time very strange that it would even be possible to perform analysis or computations on data without actually seeing this data. So how would that even be possible? And then he tried to explain this to me and then tell me that there are techniques, cryptographic techniques, that allow us to realize this functionality. And I just wanted to know more about it. So he basically sucked me into this topic. And a couple of years later, I'm still enthusiastic about all of this.
Great. Excellent. So now TNO has a relationship with the Dutch government. Tell us a bit about that and TechRruption.
TechRruption, yeah. Okay, so the relationship with the Dutch government. So first I should mention or emphasize that TNO is an independent research institute. So we have a little bit of a strange position in the Netherlands, and that's namely that we are founded by law. So basically in the Netherlands, there is a TNO law that says there should be an institute such as TNO performing applied research. But it's also very important that we are independent from the government, because we sometimes also get asked to validate or assess certain decisions or projects from ministries and those kind of things. And for that, it's really important that we have an independent role. So that's our relation to the Dutch government. But one of the main goals of TNO is to create innovation ecosystems in which government, industry, and academia collaborate. So we really want to stimulate innovation, and basically our role as an applied research institute is to bridge the gap between academia and industry and academia and government, and bring more fundamental knowledge to practice. And TechRruption is an example of such an innovation ecosystem. So that's like a collaboration. I think there are like 50 different parties involved in this collaboration. And within this collaboration, there are a lot of different projects in which we try to work on different technologies. And TechRruption specifically focuses on a number of topics, which are blockchain technology, multi-party computation, but also artificial intelligence and self-sovereign identity, for example. So this is just an example of one of the ecosystems in which TNO plays a big role.
Excellent. So now, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, those projects, and actually maybe even before that, talk about you know, how do we move like multi-party computation, which is a focus area, from something that is theoretical or even purely technical into practice. And maybe you could elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah, of course. The first multi-party computation protocols already stem from the 80s, from the mid-80s. So they're quite old already. But back then, the protocols were definitely theoretical and not very efficient. So they were not applicable to many real-world situations. So what we see the last, 10, maybe even 20 years, what we see is that these technologies have been improved significantly. So a lot of academic research effort has gone into improving these technologies, the efficiency thereof, and thereby making them applicable. And I think, a big example was from 2009, where in Denmark, multi-party computation was applied to facilitate sugar beet auctions. So that's like a famous example of it, showing that these technologies are becoming more and more applicable. And since then, since 2009, the applicability has improved much, much better. So we see this development going on.
Do you think those improvements were related to the scalability, you know, the processing throughput? Do you think it was the interfaces, the usability? Do you think it was the underlying technology was enhanced? Where do you think the greatest improvements were made that really facilitated moving from something that was purely theoretical to something that was starting to become practical?
Yeah, so I think at first the main improvements were scalability. So improving the performance of these protocols. So when you apply multi-party computation protocol, you always have some sort of overhead. So it's always a bit harder to do the computations in a privacy-preserving manner than if you would want to do these protocols without caring about privacy at all. So, and this overhead has reduced significantly. So these are really technical enhancements that have taken place in making these things applicable. And that's something that's still going on. So people are still working on these techniques and still making them more efficient, more applicable. But what we're also seeing right now is that if we want to apply these techniques, then we do not only encounter technical challenges, but also legal challenges, ethical questions arise, governance issues. So these are all sorts of non-technical questions that you encounter when you want to try and apply multi-party computation in the real world.
So do you want to maybe develop on some of the legal, ethical, and governance considerations?
Yeah, sure. So for example, let's take a look at the legal considerations that play a role. So what MPC basically allows, it allows parties to analyze data in a privacy-friendly manner. But it still means that MPC or the application is processing sensitive information. And a lot of privacy regulations are in place to sort of prevent the analysis of sensitive information or the use of sensitive information. So you need a valid ground for being able or being allowed to process sensitive information. So in Europe, for example, we have the GDPR, which is a privacy regulation. And in the Netherlands, we have other sorts of regulations that sort of prevent you from just processing sensitive information. So there are different ways to get a valid ground for processing sensitive information. One way could be consent. So if the data subjects, they give consent for you to use their data, then you're allowed to do it and you can perform your analysis. So that's one way to go about it. Another example is that some institutions, they have a legal task to perform certain analysis. This legal task also gives them a valid ground for processing sensitive information. An important example is, for example, in the Netherlands, Dutch banks or the banks are obligated to prevent and detect financial crime, for example, money laundering and fraud and those kind of things. So criminal money flows, the Dutch banks should try their best to detect these criminal money flows. And if they do not do this appropriately, then they can receive huge fines. So these fines can go up to hundreds of millions of euros. And in the last couple of years, at least two big Dutch banks have received these kinds of fines. So they have this legal task of detecting financial crime, and that requires them to analyze transaction data, so sensitive information, the transactions between their customers, for example. So this gives them valid ground for processing information. But even if they are allowed to process this information, there are still restrictions to what they can do. So for example, the Dutch banks cannot just share their information with other banks. So they have to keep this data in-house, which already limits them in what they can do with this data, because they cannot see the transactions that do not take place within their network, for example. So that already limits their view on the transaction network. So these are sort of legal considerations that you really have to take into mind when you want to apply multi-party computation or when you want to process sensitive information, whether you do it with or without cryptographic or privacy-enhancing technologies.
Great. So for example, like, you know, when we typically hear about these privacy-enhancing technologies, use cases being compelling in healthcare research on the financial side for regulation, those are probably some of the most compelling, although there are other compelling uses for analyzing data statistically. Yeah. And so in one context, you still have to get consent, but using this data can be a minefield. You know, if you inadvertently disclose it, if you want to share it with others to greater facilitate your ability to analyze the data, you run all sorts of risks that could be preventative from a business, from a research perspective. And then as you shift to even where there is sort of at the outset a permissive use of those of that data in the context of complying with regulation, even then you can trip up on it and inadvertently disclose it and still be subject to huge fines as well. So you sort of have this permissive and somewhat permissive, but even when you have the right to conduct analysis, you know, for anti-money laundering or otherwise, you still run the risk of still having a breach and still being liable. So, you know, particularly as we get more complex and more data-driven, it seems like a better use case is to figure out, hey, how do we insulate ourselves from this potential risk versus, you know, trying to manage it in a way that may just long-term not really be manageable.
Yeah.
So definitely. Interesting.
And what multi-party computation can really do, or other privacy enhancing technologies for that matter, is realize a much higher level of proportionality. So in a traditional approach where you do not use these privacy enhancing technologies, data is shared or copied from one place to another place and distributed in a lot of ways. If you analyze this data in a privacy preserving manner, you are processing the data in a much more also proportional manner, because you're not giving or granting access to the data by other parties. So that's an important step or value that the multi-party computation or other techniques add to this scenario.
Right. And I guess that sort of bleeds into one of your other points. I mean, in managing the legal risk, you know, you have to manage governance, right?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that, so for example, with multi-party computation or federated learning and all these sorts of techniques, the main focus is to protect the input data, so the sensitive input data, and to perform a sort of analysis without revealing this input data. But the outcome of the analysis can also be sensitive. So very simple. So this is something you have to be very careful about. So for example, if I compute the average salary of three persons, and the answer of this computation or this analysis is 1,000 euros a month. So the average salary of three persons is 1,000 euros a month. And I already learn that no individual earns more than 3,000 euros a month. So I can perform the analysis in a privacy-preserving manner, but also the result of the analysis reveals something about the individuals. So that's something you have to be careful with. And another example is if a fourth person joins this computation and we recompute the average salary, now not of three, but of four persons, then it is very easy to deduce the fourth person's salary by comparing the two different averages. So these are typical things that are not automatically taken care of when you apply multi-party computation. So when you apply multi-party computation, you also have to think about what kind of sensitive information can be deduced from the outcome of the computation. So that is that can be challenging to quantify this, for example.
Right. So great. And I mean, you know, so obviously it's not just the technology, you know, there are a lot of other considerations as well. In fact, we did an episode with Rand Hindi and I said, you know, what are the big areas to think about when we talk about things like, you know, fully homomorphic encryption or multi-party computation? And he said, you know, like once we've sort of hit the holy grail, and his point was, well, I don't know what comes after it. He goes, but the policy considerations and how we grapple with how do we manage who has what, how they use it, what can be deduced from it, you know, all these policy considerations as to the use of the technology, the legal, the ethical, the governance, those will remain. And, you know, to some extent, the law and everything else will need to catch up with the technology and everything and all the challenges that it presents. So yeah, I guess that's where like us lawyers, you know, come into the picture.
Yeah, definitely. And, you can play a big role in that that part.
Yeah. So shifting gears to the readiness of the market today for these technologies, but you know, I think maybe multi-party computation seems to be the more market ready, but certainly there's a range of market ready, but certainly I think where you see a lot of talk about practical applications seems to sort of center on multi-party computation and some use of multi-party computations with other privacy enhancing technologies. But do you want to maybe elaborate on that and what you see from your side?
Yeah, so I think these times are actually quite exciting. So for example, in So the last couple of years, we have done various projects and applied multi-party computation to different domains. Most of these projects were like proof of concept demonstrators, demonstrating the applicability of multi-party computation and trying to sort of spread the word. Well, look at these techniques. They are becoming market ready, and you should think about applying them. What we are seeing nowadays is that these proof of concepts are moving to real-world applications. So, for example, recently we deployed our first multi-party computation system on real patient data. There was this project, or there is this project, where TNO collaborates with an insurance company, a hospital, and a statistics company. Well, their question was, how can we analyze or determine the effectiveness of certain medical treatments, medical procedures? And of course, they ran into all sorts of privacy issues, because if they want to assess or do this analysis, they have to analyze patient records and also information about patients that is distributed over the different parties. So some information is kept at the insurance company, other information is kept at the hospital. So this was a typical scenario where multi-party computation is applicable. And the solution that we developed was piloted this year on real patient data. And the pilot was actually quite successful. So this will be further developed and actually in a spin-off company that was recently founded, Linksight. So that's actually quite exciting to be able to tell you this today, that this is happening. And simultaneously, we also see that in 2020, another startup was founded in the Netherlands, Roosman Labs, also a company that is aiming to apply multi-party computation to all sorts of real-world problems. So it's quite exciting to see all these developments and see that we're moving from proofs of concepts to real-world applications.
So yeah, congratulations, by the way. This was, I think, announced just a few weeks ago in June. We're still in June. So, very recently. So, and, you know, certainly when we're talking about in this podcast, we'll try to bring it back to that practical experience, because obviously you were involved in it and it wasn't theoretical. You know, it was tested and then you guys actually implemented it, you know, in the real world, in a real context, and exciting. So, you know, we talked a little bit about anti-money laundering or fraud detection as use cases. You know, there are other use cases as well, some of which are, you know, you talked a little bit about treatments. And I think, you know, for certain treatments, it may be even more compelling. Maybe do you want to expand a little bit on that, what you've seen, what kind of research you've done, you know, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. So one of the first projects that I worked on where we tried to apply multi-party computation to relevant use case was about HIV treatments. So it is very challenging to treat HIV patients or to prescribe the correct medicine. And the reason is basically that HIV can appear in millions or maybe even billions different kinds of mutations. So there are a lot of different variants of this specific this virus that are around. And all of these different mutations, all of these different variants can react differently to treatments. So, and on the other end, we have a lot of different treatments. So I think there are currently over 70 different treatment regimes available, and one mutation can react very positively on a certain treatment. So this treatment can be very effective for one mutation, but can be very ineffective for another mutation. So prescribing the right treatment is a delicate procedure and a very difficult task. So what happens nowadays is that we have these systems, clinical decision support systems. These systems are in place and doctors can use these systems to prescribe the right treatment for their patients. So they basically fill in all the information they know about their patient, what kind of mutation is it, and then the system can say, well, these treatments will be effective for this specific patient. But these clinical decision support systems are not perfect. So there's room for, well, I would say, significant improvement. And these systems can in particular be improved if they would have access to more data, more information, in particular about the successfulness of prior treatments. So if a system prescribes a certain treatment, then it would benefit from learning from the successfulness of this treatment. Then it can, for example, the next time either prescribe the same treatment or another one. But this is currently not possible, because this would require the system to analyze patient data, which is sensitive. So because of its privacy reasons and because we want to protect the sensitive patient records, it's currently not possible to incorporate this additional information in these clinical decision support systems. So what we basically did is we developed a proof of concept implementation where we used information on prior treatments to improve the decisions by these automatic systems and thereby assist doctors in prescribing the right treatment.
And so for something like that, obviously, the more doctors participate, whether in the Netherlands or otherwise, you know, outside the Netherlands, obviously more as you grow that network, the better the data becomes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you see today too much in hospitals, correct? Like most it's like conferring with colleagues, but all these different little pockets of research, you know, start to become all that much more valuable when you start to tie it in across countries, right?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, where do you think the first mover will be? I know that's a difficult question, but where do you think the first mover in terms of what treatment is going to be so compelling or is going to have enough sort of international support and presumably private companies, maybe even research organizations, you know, who knows, maybe research organizations will lead it. But where do you see any movement, sort of this coalescence, or are we still sort of in an area where like we're still testing it out, we're still researching it, we're still prototyping it? That expansive view of trying to get, you know, trying to actually get all this data in. Obviously, there's scalability issues as well. But do you see any sort of international movement that you think might actually gain some steam, you know, as sort of that first use case internationally?
Yeah, so I fully agree. So if we would be able to collaborate internationally, that would be very, very beneficial for these kinds of systems, because more data gives you more insights. So on the one hand, we see that in some of the projects, we're still piloting and prototyping these kind of technologies, and we're demonstrating them within the Netherlands, for example, so within our borders. And the reason is that we first have to make sure that people also trust these technologies, that they understand that if they apply these technologies, that their sensitive data is protected. So we're also still in the phase of sort of spreading the word to become more familiar with these technologies. And because if we would already do that internationally, then we would get a lot of additional challenges, because we have different legislative frameworks in the different countries, and then that would introduce all sorts of other challenges. So on the one end, we're doing that within our borders, and I think other countries are, we see the similar kinds of prototype proofs of concept implementations. But on the other end, especially in the academic world, we do see a lot of international collaboration. So, for example, we have these European projects where we collaborate with parties in other European countries. And another good example, which I was not personally involved in, for example, is the personal health train. So the personal health train, that's sort of a system that's not focused on multi-party computation, but more on federated learning. And that is a project in which the or hospital and the university in Maastricht were involved, but also hospitals in Italy. So there we do see this international collaboration already starting to be formed and be used. But indeed, when you cross borders, you introduce additional challenges. So that is something we have to overcome as well.
Do you foresee like the federated learning model being one that facilitates the consumption and analysis of these various projects that use multi-party computation to develop these analyses and then share them through sort of a federated learning environment?
Well, that's one way we could see things develop. But I know for sure that there are some examples where it's exactly the other way around. So but we basically have this federated learning architecture. So federated learning is another privacy-enhancing technology that does not necessarily rely on cryptographic techniques. But the main idea of federated learning is that you bring the analysis to the data, not the data to the analysis. So instead of collecting all data that is distributed over many places in one central location and then training some sort of model, performing machine learning or other kinds of techniques. That's basically the traditional approach. What we now do is we keep the data separated and distributed, and we train the model locally on one of these data sets. And then we continue with the model to the second data set, and we update the model based on this new data. So that's another way of preventing sensitive data from being shared or between different parties. That's different from the cryptographic techniques, multi-party computation and homomorphic encryption that we talked about earlier. And for some applications, federated learning can be much, much more efficient because it does not involve any complicated cryptography, which can sometimes be quite costly. The downside of federated learning, however, is that it does reveal or some information is shared between the different parties or the different data sets. So the data itself stays local and is not distributed amongst the parties, but the model that is trained based on this data is shared between the different parties. So the model parameters go from one party to the other, and the second party can learn something about the underlying data of the first party based on these model parameters. So that's sort of a trade-off between the different techniques. And what we also see that some experiments where instead of sharing the model parameters directly with the other parties in the plane so that they can see these model parameters, we can also share the model parameters using MPC or using homomorphic encryption. So then we share the model is trained locally, it is being encrypted, for example, with a homomorphic encryption scheme, then it is moved to the second party, and second party can update these model parameters without having to see the model parameters. So then we see already a combination of federated learning and multi-party computation that seems to be a very a strong combination.
Excellent. So we talked about HIV, we talked about some of these other treatments. Any other ones like maybe that you think are particularly compelling for projects that are currently implementing these privacy-enhancing technologies?
Well, there's perhaps an interesting one that I did not think about before, but so we are also working at TNO on this project, combating poverty, basically. So what we see in the Netherlands is that, or in the Netherlands, we have this additional benefits or health benefit or sorry, social benefits for elderly people that live below a certain minimum wealth standard. So if they live below a minimum wealth standard, they are entitled to additional social benefits. However, these elderly are often not aware of these social benefits. Therefore, they don't apply to them and they don't receive them. And as a result, they are unnecessarily living below these minimum wealth standards. So when we want to combat poverty, we want to reach out to these people and tell them, you are entitled to these social benefits, so come and get them, basically. That's what we want to do. But the problem is government agencies do not know, or the government agencies that are responsible for these social benefits do not know which people are entitled to them. Because to know that, they have to have access to the income information of the Dutch citizens. And it would be very disproportional to give all the income information of all the Dutch citizens to this specific government institution so that they can just filter and find out who are entitled to these social benefits. So this would be very disproportional, and that's not allowed to do that. So what we are working now, we're working on a multi-party computation solution for this problem where they can find out who are entitled to these social benefits without having to access the underlying data, the income information of the of all the Dutch citizens. So this is, I think this is a very interesting application of multi-party computation that we only found out because we were talking to the government agency, and they explained this problem to us, and we thought, we know a solution for this specific problem.
Excellent. And also there, you know, Linksight has something called the Care for Data platform. Do you want to describe what that is?
So basically Linksight is the spin-off company we recently founded that we just talked about.
Right.
And their main application is to analyze the effectiveness of healthcare, of certain medical interventions. And to do this, they have developed the Care for Data. Well, that's sort of a multi-party computation platform that allows them to perform these analysis in a privacy-preserving manner. And their platform actually makes use of a homomorphic encryption scheme to perform the analysis in a privacy-preserving manner. But it's not only the homomorphic encryption scheme that's incorporated in their platform, because their platform also, they also developed a governance structure. So the analysis that they want to be able to do are statistical analysis. And the statistical analysis that if you implement them naively, then they are easily misused. So, for example, one of the parties can ask a lot of different questions on the data. So can I want to compute the average for all men in this data set. And then I want to compute another average. If you make a lot of these intersections, then what you can do is you can deduce sensitive information. So you can basically deduce all the information about one specific individual that you were targeting. So this kind of misuse should be prevented. So what they did is they also built a governance structure on top of their multi-party computation platform. So that's all part of this Care for Data platform. And that prevents misuse of the system. And what they actually do is they used a public ledger technology, so basically blockchain technology, to record the amount of queries and the actual queries that the party makes to the system. And it also limits the amount of queries, the amount of questions a party can ask to the system, to the data set. So there we see a really nice application, actually, of multi-party computation and blockchain technology that makes sure that for the multi-party computation protects the privacy, and the blockchain technology makes sure that the system is not being misused. So we have an accountability, basically. All the actions are accountable by even by third parties outside of the system.
And so where does the homomorphic encryption come in? How does it, so the multi-party computation is the collection of the data. I don't know if it uses the federated learning as well, but then the blockchain also ensures that you don't have abuses. So it's recording, it provides for auditability, which is a really important feature of any of these schemes. But how does the homomorphic encryption factor in?
So typically multi-party computation, when we speak about multi-party computation, we're referring to a specific type of protocols based on secret sharing that achieve this functionality that allow you to analyze data in a privacy-preserving manner. And homomorphic encryption has a slightly different functionality. You can encrypt data and then still perform computations on this data. But there are also techniques that allow you to use homomorphic encryption to implement a multi-party computation protocol. So that's actually what's going on under the hood of this specific solution. So we want to have a multi-party computation because we have three different parties that want to perform these analysis collaboratively. But the way they do it is by using homomorphic encryption. So it's basically a technique to implement this MPC functionality.
Right. It's a way of managing the data streams you get from the multi-party computation in a way that's continues to be encrypted and privacy preserving.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Great. So layered. And when you look at the different toolkits that you have, obviously you have homomorphic encryption, you've got multi-party computation, you've got federated learning, you've got trusted encrypted environments, which have their own issues. You even have things like, zero knowledge proofs. How do you figure, which we haven't actually covered on this podcast, so if you want to actually try to tackle that one, you can, but if you're not using it, then there's no point. We'll save it for another episode, because it gets zero knowledge proofs is sort of a whole world into itself. Totally. And we definitely need one on the show. So what are the primary considerations that you look at? Like when you sort of like have your bucket list, like, when I'm faced with a project and I'm thinking about it structurally, what are the factors that drive you to say, okay, these are the tools that we have to use, and even how do we layer them?
So that's an interesting question, because it fits really well with what an applied research institute is doing. So we try to match these two. So we have all these techniques, all these tools developed in academia. And then on the other hand, we have practical real world questions and challenges. And how do we match these? How do we find the right tool for the job, as you mentioned? So basically what we do is we always go into a project with sort of a blank sheet. So we do not decide at forehand which technique we are going to use. But we have techniques in our toolkits, multi-party computation, federated learning. And then what we do is we discuss with our partners, well, what is the problem that you are facing? What kind of analysis do you want to perform? So typically, of course, the question is that we want to analyze data, but this is sensitive information. There are all sorts of considerations that come into play then. The main one is what kind of security guarantees do you want? In what way should the privacy be protected? So when we talk, for example, about homomorphic encryption, we have these homomorphic encryption schemes that are, well, relatively efficient, but they are not secure against a quantum computer. So that's something we should take into consideration when we want to deploy a scheme. So, for example, if we want to deploy a scheme that is going to be used for a long time or that is going to analyze data that should be secured for a long time, then we should already start thinking about the threats of quantum computing. And then we should not deploy a scheme that we know will be insecure once a quantum computer arrives. But that's something that has to be considered. What we also see is that some of these protocols, so there's not really a silver bullet, so there's not one protocol that is best for all solutions. So some protocols require quite significant or induce quite a significant computational overhead. So they require a lot of computational power, strong computer, strong surface to perform the analysis, for example. So that can be a downside. But on the other hand, you have other protocols that can be computationally relatively efficient, so they do not incur this huge computational overhead, but they do require interaction between the parties. So for example, if we see fully homomorphic encryption, the nice thing about fully homomorphic encryption is that we can create a sort of an MPC functionality without having to communicate a lot. We just have to encrypt the data, send it to one party, and this party can perform the analysis on the encrypted data. It can take a while, but it does not have to communicate, and then send the answer back to the or the result back to the input parties. So that's a nice thing about fully homomorphic encryption, and that it's very convenient in some practical applications. But in other applications, we cannot have this computational overhead. We have to compute sort of analysis. We have to perform an analysis instantaneously. Then you can, for example, look at secret sharing based multi-party computation protocols, where the computations are much less involved. They can be performed much quicker, but the protocols do need interaction. So we have multiple parties involved in this protocol, and while they are performing the computation, they have to keep interacting. So you can only perform a multi-party computation protocol when all these parties are online. If they are distributed over the world, so one party is in the Netherlands and the other one is in New Zealand, for example, then we also have quite a lot of latency between the two parties, and that can make certain MPC solutions inapplicable. So that's also something we have to take into account when you want to apply different technologies. So the main message, I guess, is that there's not one silver bullet. We still have to really perform some cryptographic engineering to find the right solution, the right tool for the job.
Right. And the point that you made about post-quantum computing and the risk of a fully homomorphic encryption scheme, you know, if it's built for a long term, it's really interesting. So that suggests that, you know, where you are thinking about the privacy impact of, and you know, like you're going to the government and saying, hey, we got this great solution and it's privacy. And it's like, woohoo, I'm so excited. And then post-quantum computing, and it's like this big honeypot, you know, to be attacked. Like you place a lot of trust into the homomorphic environment because you believe, you know, based on today's tech, you're fairly confident that it's the best solution. But then lo and behold, it becomes the very thing that is a target later on. And so it sounds like in that case, you're thinking more in terms of maybe federated learning and multi-party computation, where you're just pulling the results, but the data is residing in all the sources. So you don't have this single honeypot of risk. Is that one way of framing it, or I'm sure I've made it too simplistic.
I think that's the right way of framing it. So basically, you have all these sorts of threats that you have to take into account, and to mitigate these threats, you can deploy different techniques and combine them. Not only to mitigate threats, but sometimes it's also much more efficient to combine federated learning with multi-party computation than to just deploy the naive protocol in a multi-party computation architecture directly, for example. So this is also something we do. And
Excellent. It's great stuff. One of the areas, you know, since you have this sort of practical experience with it, do you maybe want to kind of share like one experience you had where you came into a project with one set of assumptions? you know, you had the discussion and you were like, okay, this is what applies. And then that thing that came out of left field where you were just like, okay, wow. Like, I wish you would have thought about that sooner. Like that key learning moment. Obviously, every organization, you know, learning from challenged assumptions over time is really the strength. Nobody gets it. I'm giving you it out. Like if you share something, it's not like, you know, it's part of the learning process, but anyway.
Yeah. So, indeed, we have quite a lot of these learning processes that we find out that we had it all wrong in the beginning, and then we have to pivot a little bit.
Yeah, it'd be great if we always got it right the first time, right?
Yeah. I guess that's not...
Or even the second time, right?
Not realistic to hope for that. But I can give an interesting example. So a while back, we also did this project, and we were working on optimizing the workflow in a hospital. So basically, we had a hospital, and they wanted to optimize their workflow. So to make sure that patients do not have to wait too long, and then optimize the entire process within this hospital. And what they wanted to do to achieve this is they wanted to use location data. And this, so basically all the staff members, so all the doctors, nurses, and everyone working in the hospital, they received a badge with sort of a GPS tag in there so that they could track the location of their employees during the day. Same thing happens for patients visiting the hospital, and using this data, they sort of wanted to match the movements from patients and staff members and optimize the workflow within the hospital. But you can imagine that, for example, this location data is very sensitive, especially the location data of the staff members, because this location data shows whether a doctor is assisting or is visiting a patient and really working, or whether it is standing at the coffee machine and then taking a short break. So you can imagine that the staff members do not want to share this information with the hospital, their employer. So what they did is basically they make sure that this data is managed by the union. So the union they trust, and the union can see this location data of the staff members of the hospital. But to optimize these workflows, what they had to do is they had to combine this location data of the staff members with the location data of the patients. And this patient data was owned by sort of kept by the hospital. So we have two different parties, two different data sets, and to perform the analysis, we have to combine the data sets, but for privacy reasons, we cannot just do that in a traditional manner. So, of course, NPC allows a privacy-friendly solution, so it made a lot of sense to start thinking and start working about a multi-party computation prototype for solving precisely this issue. But when we started doing that, we sort of took a closer look at the application and the computation that actually has to be performed. And we found out that we could redesign the algorithm and perform certain computations locally. And by doing that, we could perform the entire analysis without having to share the data and without having to use MPC at all. So this was really a result of taking a closer look at the exact algorithm and then that sort of dissecting it and rearranging the algorithm and finding out that multi-party computation was not required at all, but you can just perform the computations locally. So that was actually quite interesting. We started off with a project, and the goal was to apply multi-party computation to solve privacy problem. But in the end, we managed to solve all of it without multi-party computation in actually a really a simple manner. So that's also something that's good to take into account. So dive into the algorithm and then see whether you can do something more efficient than just naively applying a cryptographic protocol.
Interesting. I mean, it sort of points to maybe some of the issues also with fully, you know, with homomorphic encryption, which is you have all these different levels of centralization, right? Where the computation is being performed, how much of the data is being retained, all that stuff. And it seems like in this case, you know, even though multi-party computation is more privacy preserving and not as centralized, and again, it's my own word for centralization, as maybe a homomorphic encrypted scheme, you know, what your solution basically was about sort of decentralizing or localizing that data more and not aggregating in a way that raised some of those concerns. So that's a very key consideration, right? So
a lot of these techniques, such as fully homomorphic encryption, multi-party computation, maybe even federated learning, they can be sort of applied in a black box manner to an algorithm. So we compute an algorithm or do an analysis on sensitive data. Okay, then we plug in MPC, federated learning, or fully homomorphic encryption. But when you do that, that's typically not going to be optimal. So that's going to be incur quite a large overhead. And there are often much more efficient ways of performing this analysis. So typically you need to redesign the algorithm a little bit to make it more suitable for multi-party computation or any of the other techniques.
Excellent. So another application I think Tino has done some work on it is the Netherlands Comprehensive Cancer Organization. Do you want to maybe touch on that and talk about some of their, you know, the unique challenges and sort of the you know, where it differs from the HIV and some of the other research that you've done?
Yeah, sure. So the difference here is mainly that the Netherlands Comprehensive Cancer Organization is already, well, a very large research institute with a lot of data locally available. So they already do all these analyses and they already have a lot of information at hand. But there are some data sources that they cannot access yet. So even this organization that has already all this information and is already performing this analysis and also they are, so a lot of data subjects just give consent for this organization to analyze their data because of their cause is to improve the treatments of cancer. So a lot of people give consent for this organization to process their information for this this good cause. But there are some other factors that influence a patient's chance of survival, for example, when they have cancer. And they don't always have access to this information. So for example, the drug usage of patients. So whether they have a history of drug abuse or other kinds of other kinds of abuses or hereditary conditions. These are examples of information that could play an important role in the effectiveness of the treatment of cancer for which they don't have access to. So what we are trying to do with this organization is also to develop sort of framework, a system that allows them to perform this analysis and to also incorporate data from other organizations in their analysis. So what we don't really have one specific computation or analysis that we want to do. This should be like a multi-party computation framework that should allow them to do generic analysis on cancer patients' data.
Interesting. I'm also actually today, I'm doing another podcast with Somos in Genobank, and they basically are collecting DNA genomic information on, you know, indigenous peoples and forming a database that would allow people to identify, you know, certain tendencies, certain health risks. But, you know, sometimes the challenges of doing this, like in a multi-party computation environment, are high. And so in their case, they're not employing homomorphic encryption. Their view is that they'll manage the database itself, you know, and protect it. So do you think that, I guess my question is a multi-party computation environment something that is easily overlaid where maybe the desire is just simply to get something to market, to pull it in from so many disparate resources first, and then maybe figure out the privacy later? Like, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, certainly in Europe, where I think there is a greater understanding of, you know, there's a, you know, more of an emphasis on privacy. So yeah, these considerations factor in right out the gate and it avoids some of the issues that could develop later on. But what are your thoughts about, you know, maybe in jurisdictions or countries or, you know, where that may not be quite as important, and in the interest of sort of bringing something to market that has a public good, you know, maybe they don't deploy these techniques?
So I fully agree with you. So what we have seen the last couple of years that privacy has become a topic in many public debates in Europe. We have the GDPR, so that's the renewed regulations. They were renewed in 2016, I think, and in 2018 they became effective in Europe. So these prescribe how to how to handle sensitive information and data. So this is quite an important topic in the Netherlands, and in an early stage, already in an early stage, when we're working on new technologies, new platforms where data is being analyzed, we are already sort of forced to think about privacy considerations. So as an example, we typically work with privacy by design. So already in the design phase, we have to think about the privacy challenges and investigate what kind of mitigating measures are available. So I think that's also the way you should go about it, because it is always very hard once a system is up and running to modify it and to sort of plug in cryptography or other paths at a later stage. So I think that's going to be much more challenging than when you think about this in advance, because sometimes you do need structural changes in how you go about analyzing data. So, for example, you might not want a central location to store data anymore. You might want to have a distributed data storage where data is cut into different parts such that none of the individual parts are intelligible, but only when you bring them together you can perform your analysis. So I think that should be the way to go about this. But still, sometimes there is a trade-off between a functionality that you want to achieve and the costs of these privacy-preserving technologies. And I can imagine that there are some applications where the costs of these technologies are still a little bit too high to apply them directly.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could even see maybe a world where, you know, once you have post-quantum computing capabilities, like the ability to crack into some of these databases in ways that we thought were previously secure, would be interesting to see is, like, you know, for example, we often talk about insurance providers and the ability of insurance providers to discriminate and deny coverage to people who need it based on even some sort of genetic propensity. Yeah. And, you know, which would have certainly would be very hard on people who are particularly, you know, poor or underprivileged or don't have access to it to then get it, because then they have this added layer. And I guess you could see a world where, you know, you have a bad actor collecting this information, but then somehow cleansing it and selling it to, you know, something that appears more legitimate. And like say, hey, insurance provider, there's this database you could provide that, you know, we collect the whole source of information from XYZ. And I mean, who's going to really actually go and pull the threads on all of that and say, hey, we provide this whole database to you and it helps you sort of identify, you know, where, you know, you're likely to suffer a loss because you insured somebody who had a predisposition. So it's to your point, it's something that I would anticipate at some point in the future, there'll be some sort of event that draws that into sharper focus.
Yeah.
And then companies that are, you know, particularly, you know, in Europe where there's a greater emphasis are going to be better positioned to sort of execute on, you know, sort of that growing awareness and say, okay, now we get it. Right? Yeah. Like, this is not the result we wanted. How did this happen? And then it sort of drives it forward. And I think Europe gets it. Maybe America a little less so. You know, Americans are a little more likely to sacrifice privacy for better outcomes, or most people don't even, you know, they're sort of more immune, but privacy by design is definitely more of a European focused initiative. In the US, I guess growing, but certainly not where Europe is yet. Maybe in California, I don't know.
Well, hopefully you'll catch up then.
Well, there's always a balance. There's always a balance.
Yeah, I agree with you. But you gave a nice example. So, for example, in this privacy regulation, there's also something said that there's the right to be forgotten. And this is very hard to realize in the traditional manner where data is centrally stored and shared with other parties. And if you want to be forgotten, if you want to have your data record removed, for example, for some reason. So, for example, if someone has made a mistake. So if someone has said, well, I think Thomas is a criminal, for example, and it puts this information in one data record and this data record is shared then with another institution and this institution shares it with three other institutions, then it is very hard for me to rectify this, because I have to track down all these places where my data is stored and where it is indicated that I'm a criminal, and I have to convince all of them that is not true, that there was a mistake made in the beginning of the phase of the chain. So that is very hard to realize in this traditional manner. Well, if you apply MPC and other privacy enhancing technologies, data is not shared amongst different parties. So it's much easier to keep control of information.
Right, for sure. Well, listen, this was a great discussion. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about what TNO is doing, more about you, and even Linksight, I don't know to what extent you're still engaged with that, but certainly TNO is, where can they find it?
So I'm not really involved in Linksight, but Linksight has a website, so you can find more information on their website, and also at our TNO website we have a lot of information about different projects that we've worked on, There's also contact information available, so feel free to reach out if you have further questions. Should be easy to find.
And what about you? What about people want to follow some of the work that things that you're working on or commenting on?
So what I'm working on. So most of the work that I do, I try to be publish as much as I can about the work that we're doing. So it's always good to receive feedback and to have other people also learn from the things that we've learned within our projects. So also at the TNO website, I would recommend just looking around over there. You will find me as well.
Excellent.
Easily.
Well, great. Thanks so much for coming on. It was wonderful to have you as a guest.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Eric. I enjoyed our discussions.